This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, two growing movements for social change are hitting their stride in the United States. Low-wage workers in the fast food industry went on strike in nearly 200 cities, while almost as many localities saw protests against police lawlessness and impunity. But first, after literally years of resistance from the CIA and the Obama administration, the Senate Intelligence Committee is preparing to release a heavily censored version of its report on U.S. torture of prisoners. The report does not even use the word torture in describing the pain inflicted on detainees. We spoke with Shahid Buttar, executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee in Washington. He says the soon-to-be-released document is of historic importance.
This could be the most important document with respect to revealing the crimes of U.S. intelligence agencies since the Pentagon Papers. There hasn't been anything of this sort in a generation in America. And it's striking that even after the several years and millions of dollars it took to compile it, that it took this long to see it. You know, people have been clamoring for the release of this report, including members of Congress from both of the major political parties, for literally years. And the efforts that were arrayed by the CIA to continue keeping the truth from the public included not only destroying evidence of torture with the videotapes that were destroyed years ago, not only hacking the U.S. Senate, committing espionage operations against the people's representatives, not only stealing Senate documents, not only filing false claims at the Justice Department attempting to intimidate Senate staff doing their jobs, and not only lying about all of that, but all of that together. Remember, this is to cover up underlying human rights abuses that no one's ever been held accountable for. The one thing that I think is really striking in this moment of history is the dramatic difference between the different systems of justice. You know, if you're a young, unarmed Black man, you face extrajudicial assassination for having not even done anything wrong. Whereas if you are a torturer, you can continue drawing a taxpayer-funded paycheck as large as $250,000 for life in the case of Ninth Circuit Judge Che Bybee, despite Goering's culpability for violations of our species' most fundamental commitments. There is clearly no equal justice in this country, and no two things make it more clear than torture with impunity juxtaposed with mass incarceration.
And in fact, the United States does not officially have a definition of torture.
Indeed. I mean, to this point, you know, torture has been, under the Bush administration, it was an instrument of enhanced interrogation. Under the Obama administration, it's forced feeding at Guantanamo Bay, as well as the continued practice of solitary confinement that occurs across the U.S. prison system. You know, torture is unfortunately endemic across the United States. And even if we didn't think of forced feeding and solitary confinement as torture, even though the rest of the world does, we at least are violating international law every day, and we have every day under the Obama administration, but we failed to prosecute credible allegations up the chain of command everywhere that the evidence leads.
As you said, people have been waiting on this report for years. This is not just a case of the CIA, one agency, stonewalling the Congress, is it, though? It seems that the administration and the CIA are playing tag team of a kind.
Absolutely. I mean, this is exactly what we should expect from a recidivist agency with such a rogue background. And it's worth noting, starting this week on December 10th through the 15th, is a national week of action around the country to draw attention to CIA and NSA crimes, including mass surveillance in the case of the NSA and torture by the CIA. But it goes one step further. The cover-ups that the CIA has engaged in surrounding torture are just the latest of their agency's crimes. If you go back into the 80s, and it's interesting to connect, for instance, CIA secrecy to Ferguson, and it's not that hard. People think of police militarization in this country as an isolated phenomenon. It was grounded in a specific history. The reason police are militarized in the United States is because in the 1990s, they were facing and being outgunned by drug traffickers in U.S. cities around the country. These were drug traffickers equipped and trained by the Central Intelligence Agency. And that's not a conspiracy theory. The CIA admitted it. This is what became the Iran-Contra scandal. And we are dealing with militarized police because of the last time the CIA got away with human rights abuses spanning multiple continents. The torture scandal is the most recent arena. Well, not even. Actually, the drone strike regime is even more recent than that. But the CIA has a history of human rights abuses. It's what it does. Sort of the Human Rights Abuse Agency. But the interesting thing about the current moment is I think Americans are waking up to the various ways in which we are paying costs for the human rights abuses that the CIA committed. When it was running drugs into Latin America, we paid the price with militarized police, and that's part of what the movement in Ferguson and elsewhere is responding to. When the CIA was committing torture, even before that, when it was training the precursors to Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan in the 1980s, what did that lead to? Not only the 9/11 attacks, but the NSA dragnet mass surveillance. We've been paying the price for CIA crimes for years without policymakers or the mainstream press pinning the tail on the donkey.
But there is this tendency to speak of the CIA as if it is this self-contained entity. It's a law unto itself when it is connected to an administration and to previous administrations.
You know, it is absolutely an extension of administrations, but to be fair, you know, it's not clear how much authority over the CIA the president actually wields. We do know, for instance, that the agency has lied to multiple administrations. And I think it is true that it is, I'll put it this way, it's an anti-democratic agency, not only in the sense of assaulting fundamental rights, but it does seem to be, for all intents and purposes, immune from public oversight. And that should be a very troubling question, because if we claim on the one hand to live in a democracy, and if the president doesn't control the CIA, it begs the question, who does? And the answer to that question is not particularly clear. I'm not the only one asking it. There's a professor at Tufts University who used to serve on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff who just wrote a book making exactly this point, National Security and Double Government. And his point is, with respect to the NSA or the CIA or vast parts of the military-industrial complex, it doesn't matter who you vote for because the president really doesn't command any of it. It's an entrenched staff of bureaucrats like John Brennan, for instance, who have sort of insinuated themselves and rendered themselves above the law and above public accountability. And that is a very profound problem in a country that claims to lead the free world.
If the president himself, the commander-in-chief, is not fully in control of the CIA, then what can a Senate committee do in terms of oversight of that agency?
Well, the biggest thing is just to expose its crimes to the public. The CIA is hidden, and its crimes are hidden not only by a culture of secrecy, but by the complicity, oftentimes, of the members of Congress who are charged with overseeing it. And before, I was remarking just a few minutes ago about how remarkable it is that despite having spent millions of dollars and years compiling this report, the Senate had to fight for this long for anybody to have a chance to read it. Just last week, on December 4th, it would have been, we delivered 250,000 signatures to Senator Mark Udall, who is a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who will not be returning to Congress. And our message to him was, regardless of what the CIA eventually allows to be released to the public by way of limited information, we would like to see him exercise his absolute privilege as a sitting member of Congress to read portions of the report into the congressional record. This is how we found out about the Pentagon Papers, when Senator Mike Gravel said, I don't care if this classified analysis of the Vietnam War is secret. It reveals a mass deception in the same way that the CIA torture report reveals mass deception and worse, human rights abuses that severes outright rape and even murder of detainees in U.S. custody. These are facts that have to come to light because as long as they remain under the rug, we will have unanswered questions that others have raised. You know, it's not as though no one's saying that we tortured some folks. Even the U.S. president has said that. But we've never had an accounting of how we tortured folks, how many people we tortured, how we tortured them. Did anyone who committed those violations face justice? And you know, one last thing I'd say here is when we ask about what a Senate committee could do, and you know, the fundamental answer is transparency. That's the first step to accountability. And it's worth noting why we have an international human rights regime in the first place. Why is there an international ban on torture? Because we fought a world war to set that up. And we sent a Supreme Court justice to prosecute the Nuremberg trials. And it was bad, obviously, for the Bush administration to torture people. That violated the Nuremberg trials. But the precedent, the legal precedent from Nuremberg, was reversed not under the Bush administration. It was reversed under the Obama administration because the decision to look forward and not back compromises the legal principle that if you commit torture, you go to jail. It doesn't matter if somebody gave you orders. It doesn't matter if you thought there was an emergency. Those were defenses that were raised in Nuremberg and rejected. Those are legal defenses that did not carry water. We fought a world war to set up a human rights regime that said if you commit torture, you go to jail. The administration under which that was lost was the Obama administration. And I think the one thing that a Senate committee, or in this case of Senator Udall, an individual senator, could do is by giving transparency to the issue, enable the rest of the system to work and demand the accountability that to this point the secrecy has precluded. I think that's what we are looking for, is to finally get the facts on torture. And even despite the limited release of portions of the report that were redacted, we still don't know the facts, right? And we won't know the facts until the rest of the report becomes clear. Remember when the Senate sought the declassification of portions of the report, the only part it even wanted the public to see was the executive summary. Why don't we see the rest of it? If the document reveals crimes by people being paid with U.S. taxpayer dollars, why is that still secret? And those are things that all of us, certainly the courts and prosecutors, should know.
Yes, international treaties to which the U.S. is a party and which have the force of U.S. law require that there be remedies, there be punishment, and there be compensation for the victims of torture. But none of that has happened.
That's exactly right. And it's worth noting that the violation of international law includes not only torture in the first instance, but also the failure to prosecute. That's an independent, continuing violation of international law. And it makes, quite frankly, America a rogue state. We can say whatever we want about the land of the free and the home of the brave, but at the moment, there are few countries doing more to damage human rights around the world than the United States. There are other countries that might be doing worse things, but there are no countries that are doing things in as blatant disregard for the legal principles that they also espouse, on the other hand. And of course, we do this while claiming the leadership of the free world, which makes it even worse, because other countries that want to abuse human rights cite our example increasingly as the basis for their own violations. And that's exactly the people who fought World War II are rolling in their graves.
That was Shahid Buttar of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. The movement to oppose police murder and abuse of Black Americans grows by leaps and bounds. Demonstrations have been nonstop around the country ever since a grand jury failed to indict the cop who killed Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. Marsha Coleman Adebayo is with the Hands Up Coalition in Washington, D.C., which last week presented a list of demands to the U.S. Justice Department. Dr. Coleman Adebayo is a noted whistleblower and an editor and columnist for Black Agenda Report. She says the new movement is wrestling with fundamental questions of power in America.
One demand is that you may not kill our children, because we certainly can't wait until we have self-determination before we put that demand on the table. And that goes to the issue of militarization. The Pentagon has said that it placed all these weapons of destruction, the tanks and the body armor and the guns that can shoot through buildings. By the way, they all have vanadium in them, which is a strategic mineral that's being mined in South Africa that I blew the whistle on. But they all provided these weapons of mass destruction to police departments in order for them to fight local terrorist groups. But what we saw in Ferguson is that the terrorist group that they decided to point their weapons at were just everyday people. So in a way, you have to ask the question, do they see us as everyday people, as terrorists, domestic terrorists in the United States? Because that was certainly the scene out of Ferguson with the body cladding and the tanks and all this stuff. So it's important that we get these instruments of death out of our communities, and that we really do place that demand upon the government. Now, Obama also made some comments at that round table about the militarization. He's tasked, I think, Holder again with investigating the needs of this kind of efficient military equipment in these communities. And so supposedly in the next 5 or 6 years, we'll get a report out of the Department of Justice on this issue. I'm sure they're probably waiting until he'd be very happy for this report to come after he's left office. So we're in a bad situation right now. And I think a part of one of the reasons why the coalitions have been so broad in this country is because I think at least the black left and black liberals understand that these guns and these weapons and these tanks are being aimed at African Americans today. But should they rise up on the anti-war issue or wage issue or really pressing demands around health care or whatever the particular issue is, that those very same military weapons will also be pointed at them. So it's really forced a very interesting coalition between a lot of groups. And I'm really happy to see how broad-based these coalitions have become.
Another of the demands that you presented to the Department of Justice was the call for a comprehensive review of systematic abuses by local police departments. But even at present, local police departments do not consistently report data to the federal government, and the federal government, the FBI, doesn't force them to. And the Wall Street Journal had a report that said that local police departments have hidden literally hundreds of homicides by police.
Right. And so, you know, this is another area where I think it's important, again, while we're on this journey to a much broader and just society, that we have to, again, press these kinds of demands. We need to know. We need to know the data. I mean, one of the things we did with the No Fear movement is that when I filed my lawsuit against the EPA on the basis of race and color and sex and retaliation, I didn't know how many people in the agency I worked in had filed complaints similarly to what I was filing. I didn't know how to contact them. I didn't know how to tap into a community of other people who were fighting the same fight within not only EPA, but in terms of the entire federal government. One of the things that we did with the No Fear Act of 2002 is we pressed that demand through legislation that we wanted to know, you know, how many people were complaining of whistleblower retaliation, of racial discrimination, of sexism and discrimination because of national origin. And so we passed that piece of legislation. And so now if you go to any government website, you can literally go to the No Fear icon, White House, CIA, it doesn't matter, press the No Fear icon, and the data will come up. It will give you an idea of how many people in the federal government have filed discrimination complaints. We need that same kind of database, and there are a lot of problems with the database. First of all, we have the agencies themselves self-reporting, so you have a conflict of interest going on. But at least we have some notion, some idea of how many people are complaining about retaliation or discrimination in the federal government. We need that same kind of database for murders, for rapes, for whatever it is that we're dealing with inside the Department of Justice. One of the things that I would hope is that we could learn from the mistake of the No Fear legislation, and this is really not of our making. This is what the government did after the law was passed, in terms of how they sort of structured these kinds of databases, is that they wanted to self-report. Well, now we're sort of clued into these people so that if we're able to press that demand and find out exactly how many black men and boys are being shot per month by law enforcement officers in this country, we want to make sure that it's an independent investigating arm, a national organization and such, that could actually carry out these kinds of research and not allow the Department of Justice to self-report. That's very important.
You've done your share of movement work in the trenches. What's your assessment of where we're at in terms of the response so far, organized and unorganized?
That's a really, really interesting question for me because I spoke at a community forum, and one of the things that I keep hearing particularly young people say, and I think it's because, you know, they're out in the street every single day And they're getting arrested, and they're closing down highways, and they're putting their bodies in the street, and it's just all such incredible and intense and beautiful activism work. But they keep saying, you know, I'm tired. And I've been trying to think about how to address that issue, because this movement is really not a sprint. This is a marathon. And so, you know, I'm concerned a bit about burnout, because so many people are voicing fatigue, and I know they're not sleeping, and maybe they're not eating well, and maybe that's a conversation that we need to have about how to pace oneself in this kind of movement. Although it's hard, because so much of what you're doing is sort of adrenaline-based. But, you know, I think there's an arc. There's a mathematical equation that I won't get into now that we use in political science. When we're looking at movements and the trajectory of a movement, and we're looking at sort of a timeline and what are the issues that are being, what are the demands that are being placed upon the political, you know. And so we're able to make some predictions, plus or minus 5-10%, in terms of a direction of a movement. And so there's an arc here. There's certainly an arc that's going in the right direction. And we see the political system, it's really on the ropes. I mean, they haven't really pulled out the real dirty tricks yet. Right now, they're still sort of waiting to sort of see where all this is going. And when you see someone like Obama, who never wanted to talk about race, and now, you know, he has, you know, had to make some compromises in that area, and, you know, where he's had a round table, he's dispatched the Attorney General to Ferguson, to Atlanta, Georgia, now around the country. You know, he's made some concessions in terms of body cameras. He's saying that there's going to be an investigation of this and that. 30 minutes after the Eric Garner travesty occurred, the Attorney General was on the television saying that they're now going to conduct an investigation to see if Eric Garner's death rises to the level of a civil rights violation. So we see that what's happening in the street is having an impact. That's first of all. We see that it is having an impact. I think political scientists like myself are at the White House right now, and they're doing the mathematical equations, and they're looking at the timelines and the history, you know, and they're looking at the demands that are being pressed, and they're trying to figure out to what extent can the system expand enough to meet some of these demands without diminishing its primary focus, which is to keep Black people under control. To what extent are they going to have to give up some demands? So I think we've got them on the ropes. The question is really one of organizing. You know, how effective can we continue to organize? You know, what are the strategies that we develop in this very important period of time so that we're efficient, and we're looking at time management, and we're looking at all the indices that will allow us to have a movement that won't burn out, that is really not a moment but a movement. We've got to assess the strength of the state in terms of, you know, when I was at these meetings, I just assumed that 50% of the people there are from the FBI. So to the extent that the state is now gathering data on the people that they consider the leaders of this movement, to what extent will the movement be able to survive these kinds of intrusions and assassinations and other kinds of government policies towards the leaders of this newly emerging movement? So there are a lot of questions. I mean, the question you asked me is an interesting question, because it's a dynamic question that maybe we should ask each other every week, which is, how are we doing? And what are the areas of struggle that we need to look at, to think about, to strategize? Which tools in our toolbox are appropriate for this particular phase of the struggle? So it's a complicated question, but I think at this point we're on an arc, and the arc is descending. But the question is, you know, do we have all the tools to keep it moving in that direction? And that's the question that I would ask as someone who studies politics and studies political movements. And I think that's an important question. But one of the things, someone asked a question about armed struggle at the meeting, and I mentioned that you, I, and Bruce were both in the Black, all of us were in the Black Panther Party, and that we come to our discussion of politics with that kind of background. And so, you know, we were involved in a movement that had a lot of possibilities and a lot of energy and a lot of dedication, and we saw the power of the state move in, and it had a lot of weaknesses. I mean, there were a lot of internal contradictions. But we also saw the power of the state. And when confronted between our movement and the resources of the state, particularly how it just became a killing machine and just wiped out almost a whole generation of black political activists, you know, the Black Panther Party couldn't survive that kind of attack. So I think that, you know, it's important that we ask those questions, and it's important that that our analysis reflects a lot of the historical struggle that has occurred in this country.
Yes, the question, how does this American state in the 21st century respond to a movement that seems to be challenging its legitimacy?
And, I mean, we saw in Ferguson where the government took off its gloves. And a lot of the stories coming out of Ferguson, you know, have not been heard yet. In terms of, you know, we saw a lot on television, but there was a lot of abuse going on off camera that we didn't see. And as we speak right now, I mean, there are study groups that have been organized at the Department of Justice, the FBI. I'm sure they've identified key people. And I'm not saying this to make people nervous at all. I'm just saying this because, you know, we come from a particular historical experience. And so it's important for people to understand sort of what we're up against. At the same time, we have somewhat of a mass movement going on now. And that really is the best protection that any of us have against the state, is to keep the community in the street, to keep pressing these demands. And, you know, if I can digress for a second, I mean, you know, look, we're an African-American community, which Black Agenda Report has been reporting. We didn't press any demands against this administration for 6 years. They went without a single demand being pressed. And so I'm sure they're in a state of shock. Because, you know, all of a sudden, you know, now they've got major demands before them. And one of the ways, I think, this is somewhat humorous, I think, but one of the ways that I think, you know, immediately that they're dealing with this is that, you know, Al Sharpton is organizing a national demonstration here in Washington, D.C. And, you know, and the goal of that demonstration is going to be to suck the air out of the movement. You know, to say, look, you know, I am the leader of the Hands Up Coalition. I am the leader of Black folks. Trust me to negotiate with Barack Obama on your behalf, and I will take care of this. And so, you know, so we see the system, you know, coming up with their own strategies to address the demands that are being pressed against it by the Black community.
Dr. Marsha Coleman Adebayo, speaking from Washington. In New York, Carl Dix is a leader of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, which for several years has been in the forefront of street actions against police impunity. Dix says the Obama administration is dead wrong when it claims the issue is about establishing trust between the police and blacks.
Not in any way, shape, or form. I mean, the system is telling you that it's going to keep on doing what it has always been doing. They told us that with the Ferguson grand jury, and then Darren Wilson's statement became reality in spite of the fact that on very recognizable points, it bore no relation to reality. And then if you didn't get that message, they told you again with refusing to indict any of these cops who murdered Eric Garner, because there it was on videotape. And we need to, as we reflect on that, think about Obama saying, we're going to put body cameras on cops and that'll help solve this problem. There we had video of what happened. We saw the murder. We heard the man say, I can't breathe. And the system managed to convince those grand jurors that they didn't see what they saw, they didn't hear what they heard, and now they're trying to tell us that we don't know everything that happened with Eric Garner. We know what happened. It was the system giving a green light to police who murder black people, and we have to stand up and reject that. And people all across the country are in the midst of doing that right now. There were at least 15,000 folks out in the streets in New York City in a number of different protests. There were protests in Cleveland, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Ferguson, among many other places. And that needs to continue, and it needs to escalate, and it needs to get further organized.
Well, the Justice Department has just come down with yet another consent decree, this one against or with the Cleveland Police Department. Could an accumulation of consent decrees amount to some kind of actual reform?
Again, we have to look at the actual reality. The Justice Department has entered into consent decrees previously with the police department in Philadelphia, with the police department in Los Angeles. And again, this is another list that's too long for me to list. I'd be going on for like more time than you got to do this interview. And we should ask people in Philadelphia, do they feel like a Justice Department consent decree has resolved their problems with the police? This is a familiar dance that they go through usually on a case-by-case basis, where when people get angry about a particular case and the local authorities have failed to even indict the killer cops, or in the rare cases that they indict them, they usually forget how to prosecute and let them walk free, then the Justice Department comes in and says, we're going to take care of this. They investigate for a number of months, maybe even a couple years, and then drop the case, and people are supposed to forget about it. This time, they feel like they have to go farther, and they have to very publicly talk about consent decrees. They entered into a consent decree with the Phoenix Police Department. Within the last 6 months, the Phoenix Police Department Tuesday night murdered an unarmed black man whose vehicle they stopped because it resembled the vehicle of a drug dealer. They were taking the man into custody and saw a bulge in his pocket that they thought was a gun, and they shot him. There was no gun in there, and what they actually found in no way resembled a gun, but it was enough for them to kill him. These federal consent decrees do not get to the heart of the problem, which is that this system has criminalized and demonized black people. Again, let's go to Darren Wilson's testimony in Ferguson. Michael Brown looked like a demon. He charged me and I had to shoot him. Now, what's logical about saying a person who has already been shot and been shot at by a cop would turn around and charge that cop? The cop has already made clear he's willing to kill the person. That's why the person was running away. Why would he turn around and charge him? But this thing about him being like a demon, this is the message that is being put out here, that black people, especially young black people, especially males, although they shoot black females too, they shoot Latino men and women, so we don't want to take that out of the calculation. But they especially put this message out that black people are like criminals and demons, and that when police take one out, no matter how outlandish the circumstances, they're really doing it to protect the rest of society. And we have to say, no, black life matters. And we will not allow you to erase our humanity that way.
We're also told that failure of black folks to vote is the root of the problem. We even hear statements such as, black failure to vote killed Michael Brown. But Cleveland's a majority black city that has often had black mayors. It's under consent decree. Newark, New Jersey is under consent decree. It's had a black mayor and a black majority since at least 1970.
Yeah, see, this is another way that the system is trying to tell you it's your own fault that they do what they do to you. Because we have elected black mayor after black mayor. We have gotten black police chiefs appointed to head the police departments that then continue to brutalize and murder us. And in fact, if we go back about 6 years, folks elected a black president and were told we were entering a post-racial period. The point is, it don't matter who you put in the position to represent the system, they still gonna represent that system. and it's going to keep on doing what it's doing. That's why I've been a revolutionary for decades now, and that's why I'm escalating my efforts to spread the message that it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to end these horrors of police murder and everything else foul that the system does to people here and around the world. And that if you see these horrors for what they are, get with that movement for revolution, or if revolution is too much for you right now, join the movement of resistance. Let's stand together, take on these horrors, and continue to discuss and debate what it'll take. But the explanations of the system very quickly become threadbare. I mean, it was only days after Obama had touted the program to put body cameras on police that the grand jury in Staten Island told us the system don't care if you got a picture of the cops brutalizing and murdering you. We will still do it. We will exonerate them. They will not be punished in any way. We need to learn from that and get down to what it's really going to take.
A couple of years ago, you and Dr. Cornel West established the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. You personally and institutionally can take some credit for focusing the attention of people on the U.S. criminal justice system. So I think it's appropriate to ask you what stage the movement is at today.
Well, as you said, the reality of a slow genocide targeting Black and Latino people is something that is more widely recognized in society now. A lot of the folks out in the street are saying they are killing us. So we can reflect on the fact that we were pointing to reality, but now what we got to do is step up efforts to mobilize, unleash, and organize people, because a lot of what's being put out from the authorities and from various and sundry people who want to feel we can patch the system up and make it work for us is not going to lead things forward. So we have to connect with people who want to see this stop and engage them both in resistance to it, which the Stop Mass Incarceration Network is taking up. We're going to be holding a strategizing session to launch a week of outrage to the slow genocide of police terror and mass incarceration. It's going to be December 7th through the 14th. And we got to work on further organizing this effort, because it is inspiring that so many young people, such a diverse grouping of young people, people of all races and nationalities, are out in the street saying this must stop. But we got to organize that effort so that it can continue beyond this upsurge around these particular cases, because these particular cases are part of what seems to be a never-ending chain of murders by police. And we have to break that chain, and that's going to take developing ongoing organization. And I would urge people to go to the website stopmassincarceration.net to check in with and get connected with the plans for further unleashing and organizing this resistance. I would also urge them to go to the website revcom.us, because I've been issuing a number of statements, writing reports on what's going on around the country around police murder, as well as you'll find coverage there of the revolutionary movement overall. I urge people to check that out and get with this movement for revolution.
There is a price to be paid for activism. One of your most militant activists, Noche Diaz, has been pulled repeatedly out of lines of march and has been charged with incitement to riot, even though in New York City, even though no riot was forthcoming or declared.
Well, the system views reality a lot different than most people do. For them, the scariest thing is that all of these people are coming out into the street. They've decided, well, we can't do anything to stop them, but we can target who we see are the leaders. And that's what's been happening with Noche, including his most recent arrest, which was last week, where they waded into a crowd and grabbed him for inciting, and you put it very aptly, inciting a non-existent riot. Because there was no riot. There were angry people in the streets saying this must stop. A political message was being delivered, and the targeting of Noche was an attempt to suppress that message, to go at the leaders, hoping that if we grab some of the leaders, then things will begin to peter out. Things are not going in that direction. We're determined not to let them go in that direction. And as part of that, we're not going to let them get away with punishing Noche for standing with and helping to lead this upsurge of resistance. His next court date is not until January. And again, if people go to the website stopmassincarceration.net, they can read the story of his arrest and the effort that's being put together to make it impossible for them to send him to jail for refusing to accept police murder and mass incarceration.
Carl Dix of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, says you can't restore a trust that has never existed between Black America and the police. Speaking from Frackville State Prison in Pennsylvania, Abu-Jamal says the Black political class is all but irrelevant to the current struggle against police crimes.
The flames of Ferguson have eaten their fill, and its eerie glow has cast light on how impotent are the Black political class, who cannot solve a problem that is a bane of Black existence. Usually, when they speak, they seem ventriloquists who mouth the words of white politicians, drowning the deep concerns of their constituents in an ocean of empty words. Now, a collection of prominent officials have announced their intention to seriously tackle the issue of police abuse in Black communities. From the U.S. president on down, politicians, police officials, clergy, and community organizers are part of a coterie of people who have come together to restore trust between cops and the African-American community. When I saw this reference, my head swiveled. Restore trust? We wonder, when was there ever trust in the first place? The cruel, painful history of relations between police and the people is one of predation, not trust. Notably, Black police officers are part of this discussion, but are we to make note of the fact that throughout many communities, for many, many years, they were forbidden to arrest white people? Police are stationed in Black neighborhoods not to serve and protect Black people nor their property. They are there to control Black mobility and to discipline Blacks for fear they'll pose a threat to white wealth, life, or property. Period. That's real talk. Not these phony fairy tale discussions about restoring trust. For what trust can exist between the oppressors and the oppressed? Nor can body cams be the great solution that its supporters propose. Recall that cameras caught with crystal clarity the brutal cop beatings of Rodney King in L.A. and before him, Delbert Africa in Philadelphia. Despite these captures on camera, both cases were thrown out, one by a jury, another by a judge. So much for cameras, huh? Who can trust a force that killed Black Panther leader Fred Hampton in his sleep? Who can trust an agency that bombed babies, Black Move babies, in Philadelphia in 1985? How can you restore something that has never existed? Until systems change, until cops aren't the only ones who face grand juries, until they too can be sent to death row for killing children, talk about restoring trust is just that. Talk.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal in a report for Prison Radio. As protests against police impunity reached a crescendo, the movement to give low-wage workers a $15 an hour minimum wage and union representation also reached new heights. Fast food workers went on strike in nearly 200 cities last week. Kendall Sells is organizing director of Fast Food Forward in New York City. He says the Fight for 15 movement has been building for several years now.
The December 4th strikes were essentially the 2-year anniversary that this movement began. you know, fast food workers in the U.S. are fighting for $15 in a union. It began in 2012, November 29, 2012, with 200 workers in New York City that people said were crazy because they were making $7.25, and they said they needed $15 to survive, and they needed a union to deal with working conditions. And here we are, fast forward 2 years later. You know, one of the most notable things about December 4th was that it wasn't just fast food workers this time. There were fast food workers out there fighting for $15 in a union, but now they've inspired airport workers who have now joined in a fight for $15 in a union. Home care workers, typically $8 to $9 an hour jobs, they've joined in a fight for $15 in a union. We had convenience store workers, so people from like BP's and Marathon, gas stations. Those folks have now joined for $15 in a union. And then we even had dollar stores workers that were out there fighting for $15 in a union. So now what you see is a large swath of low-wage workers in the U.S. And, you know, the low-wage service sector is now like the heart of the American economy. And you see a large swath of those workers that have been inspired by fast food workers and fighting for $15 in a union. So, you know, I would say that the movement has expanded and now, you know, other industries are interested in getting involved.
Yes, you say people used to say you were crazy. I remember people thought that fast food workers, people who worked for places like Wendy's and McDonald's, were young and transient and weren't the kinds of workers that would have the discipline to wage this kind of long, drawn-out struggle.
If you look at the fast food industry, you know, if you go back prior to 2008, you know, it was a fact that folks who worked in these fast food stores were, generally speaking, you know, high school kids and college kids that were trying to get a new car or get a book bag or some new shoes or have some pocket money. You know, in 2008, when the recession hit, we lost a lot of those high-paying jobs. And over the last, you know, 4 to 5 years, what you see is the jobs that are returning to the economy are low-wage service sector jobs that pay about $7, $8, or $9 an hour. And now the people who work in fast food are now adults. You know, the average age of a fast food worker is 28 years old. Two-thirds of fast food workers in the U.S. is about 4 million of them. Two-thirds of them are women. And the average age of a woman is over 30 years old. So a lot of these workers are women over 30 with children. And these are career jobs. These are not jobs where people are trying to buy book bags and tennis shoes. These are jobs where women and men are trying to keep roofs over their heads. They're trying to feed their children and they're trying to keep clothes on their backs. And these are some of the richest companies in the world. The fast food industry is a $200 billion industry. If you look at 2012 profits, the top seven fast food companies made $7.4 billion in profit. That's with a B. That's after paying all the bills, all the salaries. They still went home with $10.4 billion in profit. And over a billion of those dollars went to McDonald's workers. So, you know, I think that what you see is that it's an industry with a lot of money and you have workers that are struggling to survive in that industry. And now they've taken to the street.
Have you seen any cracks in these corporations, any of them breaking ranks, bowing to the reality of the fact that families are being sustained on those paltry wages?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because we haven't had any direct conversations with the fast food industry. You know, the way that workers see this campaign is they are under attack, obviously, by the fast food industry, so they're fighting back. But their specific target, even with the fast food industry, is McDonald's because they understand that McDonald's is the leader and they have the ability to set a different climate in this country about standards and about what's acceptable and not acceptable. So if you look at the first quarter of this year, McDonald's, you know, after spending all of 2013, the first year of the movement, saying there none of these people were really workers at their stores, you know, the first quarter of 2014, they told their shareholders that the protests, the strikes, the online activity, the potential boycotts, like all of these things were essentially creating obstacles for them to execute their plan to win or their ability to make money, and that these fast food workers had also created a conversation in the U.S. that was about income inequality, and that if this conversation continued, that it looked like they were going to have to end up paying their workers more money. They said that at the beginning of this year. You know, since then, workers have expanded internationally. You know, in May, we had a 150-city strike in the U.S., but there were support actions in 33 countries on 6 continents where workers, fast food workers, were not on strike, but they were rallying and doing marches and doing protests in support of the U.S. fast food workers. The National Labor Relations Board ruled against McDonald's and said now McDonald's cannot hide behind their franchise owners. They're now responsible for what happens inside their stores. And then on top of that, now it's not just the fast food industry, it's all these other industries that have now, you know, gotten behind this fight for $15 in the union. So though these workers haven't had direct conversations with McDonald's indirectly, the company is sending signals to the workers, but also to their shareholders, that it looks like this movement is a huge problem and it is going to force them to have to pay their workers $15 and give them a union contract.
Yes, it does appear that you've made $15 an hour a mainstream demand. You had strikes in 190 cities this time around. What's next?
We had strikes September 4th also. So after the September 4th strike, you know, we had, it's interesting because ever since the first strike in New York in November 29th, 2012, literally after every strike, we get this influx of messages and calls and emails from workers all over the country from different industries, which is how home care workers got involved because they started reaching out. Airport workers started reaching out. And the convenience store and the dollar store workers are interesting because in Kansas City and in Detroit, after the September 4th strikes, you saw all of a sudden the convenience store workers and dollar store workers started to show up at the fast food workers meetings that they hold inside the cities. And they were saying, hey, what can we do to get involved with the movement? And these workers are interchangeable. So what we found out is a lot of the fast food workers used to work in dollar stores. A lot of the dollar store workers used to work in airports, and a lot of the airport workers used to be home care workers. They're the same workers. They just work different jobs. So I think moving forward, what people are going to see is that fast food workers are going to continue to go deep inside of fast food. You know, in 24 months, they went from one city to 190 cities in the U.S. and have expanded internationally to 33 countries and six continents. Now they've also encompassed about another five or so low-wage industries. And what I think you're going to see is the development of those industries along with other industries getting involved. And if people think that this campaign has gone far, you know, examples of that is you look at San Francisco, $15 an hour minimum wage. I remember when they said fast food workers were crazy for saying that. Look at Seattle, $15 an hour minimum wage. I remember when they said fast food workers were crazy. SeaTac, $15 an hour minimum wage. Los Angeles is debating between $13 and $15. Chicago just went to $13. So, you know, I think that you're going to see other state politicians, local politicians, and federal politicians get behind this campaign. I think you're going to see other industries, the low-wage workers, continue to get involved. And I think you're going to see an explosion that's going to happen. And if people think that this has gotten heated already, just wait to what's next.
So you're moving from simply a fast food workers movement to a broader low wage workers movement.
That is a perfect way to say it. And the reason that is because when you look at where the American economy is headed currently in the next 10 years, the jobs that are growing the fastest in America are the jobs that pay the lowest in America. So either 10 years from now, we're going to have majority of Americans that are forced to work these low-wage jobs with no guaranteed days, with no guaranteed hours, where the schedule's not posted and they call you the day of, where you can be fired any day, where you don't get raises, or we're going to have these low-wage service jobs, which are the heart of the American economy, turned into jobs where you are given a living wage because you work for companies that make billions of dollars and where you have a union contract so that you can have some stability and some ability to deal with your employer in a reasonable manner and be able to negotiate over working conditions and equipment and things like that. So, you know, I think that, yes, this is now a low-wage workers movement that has popped up here in the U.S. And over the next 6 to 12 months, you know, going into 2015, I think people are going to see a complete explosion of low-wage workers that are going to start getting involved in this movement. And they're taking to the streets. They're all about direct action. They're all about mobilizing. They're all about being unified. They're all about, you know, being seen and being visible and telling their stories. And they're going to get out here and they're going to make sure that these companies feel the pressure until they get to the table and negotiate. And that's how we're going to get these workers out of poverty. And I think what's worth noting is every year, taxpayers in the U.S. are paying $7 billion to support workers who work in the fast food industry. So workers at McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, they're being supported by $7 billion in taxpayers' money through food stamps, through SNAP, through staying in public shelters because these companies don't pay them enough money. Taxpayers should not have to foot a $7 billion bill while McDonald's makes off with $5.6 billion in profit like they did last year.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio.
Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.